On this week's 51%, we speak with Emory University professor Miriam Udell about how a 20th century movement of Yiddish literature strived to help Jewish children make sense of a tumultuous world and shape the future of Jewish culture.
There's a lot more to know about the Jewish experience, and I'm hoping that Yiddish children's literature is a way in.
We also get some tips on how to keep away holiday burnout. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. The holiday season is upon us. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and Happy Kwanzaa. Whatever you celebrate, may you find some comfort and joy this time of year. For Jewish communities, it's been a more somber Hanukkah season following the mass shooting that killed 15 people at a Hanukkah celebration in Australia. Our main guest today has been studying how Jewish communities have used literature and storytelling to help their children through hard times. Miriam Udell is an associate professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Emory University and the Judith London Evans director of its TAM Institute of Jewish Studies. She says she started looking into Yiddish children's literature about 15 years ago, purely out of curiosity. At the time, she was a mom of young kids, and despite teaching the Yiddish language herself, she had never been exposed to any children's stories in Yiddish. So she went digging, and it turns out there was a whole movement of Yiddish children's literature, starting in the early 20th century and lasting all the way to the 1970s. Like a lot of folklore, Udell says these stories aimed to pass on specific values and ideas to Jewish children. She says it was their attempt to shape the future of Jewish culture and identity before and after the tragedy of the Holocaust. Udell reviews these stories, nearly 1,000 picture books, chapter books, poems, and anthologies, in her new book, Modern Jewish Worldmaking Through Yiddish Children's Literature.
So the very first story that's written specifically for children, for child readers in Yiddish, is from 1889, but things don't really get going until right after World War I, around 1918 or so. And the reason for that is that reading had always happened kind of in the family circle, and particularly for girls. Boys would be exposed to another kind of reading culture once they went to school, and that was very focused in the early years on teaching literacy through scripture and other Jewish texts. But it was after World War I when there was a real orphanhood crisis throughout Europe that wasn't just a Jewish problem, but it certainly included Jews. And communities responded by creating what they called children's homes, which was sort of a combination of an orphanage and a school. And those institutions needed reading materials for their young people. And so that was part of the push to develop stories, poems, and eventually plays in the language of Yiddish for child readers.
So tell me a little bit more about the stories themselves. What kinds of topics and messages do these stories touch on?
So it was a very idealistic project to create this literature, and there was a certain vision of how people should be, that they should be compassionate, ethical, concerned with justice and doing right by other people. And that's really kind of woven into the DNA of these stories. So if you think about themes, the most frequently occurring theme in Yiddish children's literature is the fact that there are wealth disparities, that some people have a lot and other people have a little, and that everybody has a responsibility to do something about that. And people had really different ideas about what that course of action should be. So we have stories that depict very traditional giving of charity, where, you know, there's somebody who has more and they're able to give in a consistent way to somebody who has less. And then at the other end of the political spectrum, we have stories that say You're going to have to organize and band together and fight to get more of the wealth to be redistributed from the rich to the poor. And they teach children about collective action and labor organizing. So we really have like a wide gamut of approaches to solving this problem, but a very keen sense that nobody's off the hook, that everybody has some responsibility in solving social problems.
You mentioned you hadn't seen any Yiddish children's stories before doing this research. Were there any that you came across that, I guess, after reading it, you realized you had seen in some way, shape, or form? Like, oh yeah, that does sound familiar.
There actually was just one about a rabbi who is traveling through the desert with a caravan, and he knows that he is going to be on a trip that lasts 12 days, and therefore, by definition, there's going to have to be a Sabbath day included in his trip, which is a time when, in traditional Jewish practice, travel is prohibited. And so he makes an arrangement to have someone from the caravan stop with him and rest over the Sabbath. And they're going to go on and try to catch up to the rest of the group after the Sabbath concludes on Saturday night. And the arrangement falls through. The other person decides to go ahead and stay with the group. And the rabbi is left there with a decision to make about whether to violate his religious commitment or take a risk by staying all alone in the desert. And he decides to stay by himself and he starts to pray the Friday night prayers. And he looks up and he sees a lion. And he realizes, my life is in God's hands. And if this lion's going to eat me, so be it. The lion comes over and it turns out that he's friendly. And they kind of get to know each other and they spend the Sabbath together in very friendly, companionable fashion. And then when the stars come out on Saturday night and the Sabbath day has concluded, the lion lies down like a puppy dog and motions for this traveler to climb up on his back. And then the lion speeds him through the desert and catches him up with the rest of the caravan. So that story has actually been retold a number of times. And there's an English language children's book, a picture book that features that kind of story. But for the most part, it was really entering a whole different world of story that I had not seen anywhere else.
On this show, we talk a lot about the social and cultural messaging we receive as girls and how that impacts us as adults. So I guess were girls getting specific messages through these stories as well?
Yes, I have a whole chapter on the Yiddish new girl because one of the really big things that happens in this literary corpus that, as I said, it really gets going in the early decades of the 20th century, and it goes into the 1970s. And one of the big things that it does is that it really changes the messaging around girls and what they can do and what they can be and what they can aspire to. And it ushers in a very modern idea that I call the new girl about girls being able to adventure. And so the most common plot involving a girl protagonist is that the heroine is not where the adults expect her to be. And sometimes it's a crisis and she's lost and everybody has to look for her and she turns up safe and sound somewhere. And sometimes it's not a crisis at all. She's having an adventure. And the creators of this literature are really imagining a world in which it's safe for girls to wander and to venture forth and to dream and to become and to have a very kind of physically free and mentally free existence that they create for themselves.
So let's get into the why of it all. I mean, and we've kind of touched on it, but tell me a little bit more about why there was such a push for this literature in the 20th century and what the objective was here.
A lot of children's literature that's created around the turn of the 20th century, in the early 20th century, has to do with projects of nation building. And in fact, even before the 20th century, if we think about the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm, what the Grimms, Jacob and Wilhelm, were interested in doing was collecting the stories of the Germanic people, even before there was a political entity called Germany. And they wanted to collect these stories as part of a folkloric project to say, this is the cultural patrimony, this is the cultural legacy of our nation. And if we think about nation building projects in the 20th century, whether it's the Soviet Union after the Russian Revolution or the creation of the modern state of Israel, everybody recruits children's literature, the telling of stories to the youth of the nation, as a way of helping to build up a consciousness about this is who our nation is, this is what we do, this is what we believe in, this is how we behave. So the educators and cultural leaders who were writing in Yiddish also had that kind of consciousness, but they were not creating a conventional nation with borders and an army to defend them. Instead, they were creating a nation by investing in a culture and creating a culture. And so instead of a project of nation building, we really see Yiddish children's literature turning itself toward what I call world making, the creation of a symbolic world for the young readers of this literature to learn to inhabit with a sense of dignity, joy, and justice.
I mean, even today, we can't agree on what we want our children to be taught in school or what they can read in libraries. So, was the messaging in these stories consistent, or were there conflicting political messages being promoted?
There are definitely conflicting messages. So the literature that I'm talking about in this book all was part of what we might lump together today as the secular Yiddish left. But within that big lump was a huge range of political difference. There were Zionists who thought that the best possible future for the Jewish people lay in the land of Israel and developing that, even if they didn't expect their children to actually move there anytime soon. There were socialists who wanted to bring together the international working class. There were communists who had a similar goal, but in an even more radical way. And there were just plain Yiddishists who simply wanted to preserve Yiddish as a language and as a kind of cultural wellspring for modern Jewry. And there are all kinds of conflicting messages, not necessarily very clearly articulated clashes, but more kind of if you follow some of these stories to their logical extremes, they have different views about how the world should be, how society should be organized, what the priorities should be for the Jewish people. But that said, there were really broadly held ideas, as I said before, about teaching children to be ethical, upstanding, committed to little d democratic ideals, democratic ways of organizing society and making shared decisions about political life.
You said this really took off after the First World War and went on to the 1970s. That obviously includes World War II and the Holocaust. How did this literature survive or factor into that time?
So I would say that there were two considerations that come in. One is to figure out how to use literature to guide children who survive, children who are witnessing the events of the Holocaust at a distance because they're living in North America or Latin America, but helping them to process the decimation of their cousins, their literal cousins and their figurative cousins in Eastern and Central Europe. So that's one consideration of just how can the stories that we tell children help them to make meaning out of the grief that the entire community was thrust into by the events of the Holocaust. And then in the immediate aftermath of the war, how to double down on preserving the culture that had been so imperiled by the decimation of European Jewry. Historians estimate that of the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust, approximately 1 million were children. So if you just think about demographics and birth rates and, the devastation that that wrought on the Jewish communities of Eastern Europe, and then the kind of pressure that that created on Jews growing up in Buenos Aires or in New York or in Los Angeles or Montreal. I mean, these are enormous pressures. And children's literature was really one of the tools that the community had at its disposal to respond to those pressures and to try to articulate a case for choosing Jewish identity in a joyful way moving forward after the war.
Do you still see these stories having a significance today?
There definitely is, and not only among Jewish families, but really anyone who encounters them. And I do a lot of teaching in my position at Emory, where I'm setting Yiddish children's literature alongside other children's literatures and looking with a critical lens at how we use these stories to talk to children about ideology and politics. And so most of my students have not had any history with Yiddish literature or culture. And they're finding these stories incredibly compelling and interesting because they ask questions that are universally important about minorities and majorities, about how to be an ethical person, how to grow from a child into an adolescent into an adult, how to create a world that feels more fair, especially to those who are underdogs or who have some sort of precarious or disadvantaged identity. So all of that is really woven into Yiddish children's literature, in addition to stories that start from a very modern set of assumptions about what childhood is and what children need. So we have stories about learning to regulate yourself emotionally, which is the task of young childhood, really into the middle elementary years, of just learning how to kind of come back from a tantrum when you've experienced one. And those kinds of stories and messages embedded in the stories tend to have really broad universal appeal. I guess if there's one thing that I would like people to take away from this literature, it is the message that this is a really alive culture and that we can use children's literature as a way to gain access to that. I think that so often the Yiddish language and the Jewish people have been really shadowed by the events of the Holocaust, suffering through a genocide, and then everything that happened subsequently, and all of the political events that have happened subsequently, including s situations that are really controversial that bring us all the way up to the war in Gaza. And there's a lot more to know about the Jewish experience. And I'm hoping that Yiddish children's literature is a way in for a lot of people.
Well, Miriam, thanks so much for chatting with us. I know it's probably hard to ask you to pick a favorite, but do you have a short list of stories you'd like to share with us?
Some quick picks. The Baker and the Beggar. That is a delightful story about a baker who gives generously and then is repaid by the universe in his time of need. Everybody loves the stories of Lobzik, the clever mutt who's adopted by a very loving working class family living through the Great Depression in the Bronx. And I'll say the Sabbath in the Forest about a rabbi who spends a very magical Sabbath in a marble palace that suddenly springs up in the middle of a blizzard in the forest. So those are three to start with, but you really can travel the whole world by holding on to these stories, and I hope that people will.
Miriam Udell is an associate professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Emory University and the Judith London Evans director of its Tam Institute of Jewish Studies. Her latest book is Modern Jewish Worldmaking Through Yiddish Children's Literature. It's out now through Princeton University Press. You can learn more about Miriam's work at miriamudell.com. Miriam, thanks for speaking with me.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you, Jesse. Thank you.
Holiday season can be a stressful time of year, so much so that there's an actual word for when the holidays wear you out: holiday burnout. Laurel Vanderturn, founder of the teletherapy practice Laurel Therapy Collective in California, says it's important to remember to take care of yourself this time of year, even if it means not cooking the perfect holiday meal or getting those Christmas cards out on time. I spoke with Vanderturn for some tips on how to keep the burnout away.
Holiday burnout, it feels similar to burnout that is experienced at work, but it has this extra holiday dust on it because it isn't just confined to work. People that are experiencing burnout at work, it really is contained to that environment. Although they may experience some kind of, physiological symptoms, they may be extra tired and have it affect the rest of their life. But with holiday burnout, you're experiencing burnout at work, and then also the stress and demands of the holiday season just really kick it up a notch and make life feel like it's an extra hard mode instead of just hard mode. You're getting demands from all angles. There's extra tasks at home and at work. I know I'm personally preparing to be out of the office for a whole week and to not even check email. And the reality is, in most fields, getting ready to do that is a lot of work, right? So that's happening at work. At home, there's decorating. You might be hosting. You might be wrapping gifts or, getting traditions ready for your family. If you have children, there's the whatever mythical being that brings gifts that you have to attend to, whether that's Santa or Hanukkah elves or whatever mythical being that is, the spirit of generosity. So that's just point one, right? There's also family pressure. I know that negotiating not just where you're going to spend the holidays, but also what time and energy is given to in-laws and extended family, that creates more pressure. There's also financial strain with the holidays. People that are working hourly jobs or doing gig work, maybe they have a ton more work or less work because of the holiday, and there are just more financial obligations at the end of the year. Tons of social expectations, and then personal expectations. What do you want this, meaningful holiday to be like? And maybe your vision is outside your capacity. So there are so many variables that go into creating this holiday burnout. It's very understandable why so many people experience it.
So if you start to notice that you're feeling burned out, what can you do?
Well, first, let's look at expectations and what you are expecting of yourself or what others are expecting of you and what your capacity actually is. Because when there's a discrepancy there, that's when burnout can really set in. Let's say there's an expectation that you are going to hand make cookies for the whole neighborhood because you've always done it that way. But this year, you're also caregiving for an elderly parent, or there's some other thing going on, and it's just like, that's just too much. Like, you know what? People will be okay if you don't hand make cookies and deliver them, right? So your personal expectations, I know particularly for women, that they often have very high expectations of themselves, and then there is a kind of systemic reinforcement of like, yep, do it all, right? So adjusting expectations, permission to lower the bar, right? You can lower the bar. Protecting your time and energy, finding like non-negotiable self-care time, doing things that you would normally do, or maybe doing extra things that you wouldn't normally do to take care of yourself, is another way to help offset burnout. These non-negotiable rest blocks, really important. So you actually block them on your calendar. Like, you are booked at that time because you're resting, and it's not something that can be rescheduled. And then I like to look at this, if you think of like the hierarchy of needs, like the bottom layer is like sleep, food, water, and like, you know, some movement, right? A lot of people try and just see what, how little they can get away with on that bottom level. And that's not the way to beat burnout. So like really attending to basic needs first. And then movement is very important. Movement, even for people with, you know, limited mobility or disabilities, movement is super important. It's the one thing I'm comfortable prescribing to everyone. Move in a way that feels good and is fun and sustainable. Tending to your mental health and your social health. There are some relationships that drain us and some that really fill us up. And making sure that you're getting enough of the fill up kind of relationship is very important.
Well, Laurel, thank you for your help. I mean, is there anything about holiday burnout that you wish more people knew about?
If you're feeling burnt out, take it very seriously. This is not something that you want to push through. And just, I mean, maybe if it's like, okay, I need to push through 2 days, and then having a like really protected time for recovery. Okay, we've all been there. But if you kind of take leave seriously, even if you're considering it like an informal leave, you have a little bit of time. Hopefully you have a little time off, and treat yourself like you're sick, right? If you had a cold or a stomach bug, how would you be treating yourself? Probably very gently, letting yourself sleep a lot, eating whatever you can stomach, and just resting and not feeling guilty about it. I think we often feel a lot of guilt about resting when our injury is invisible, right? And burnout is an invisible injury. So think of it like an injury and then treat yourself accordingly.
Laurel Vanderturn is a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in burnout, anxiety, EMDR therapy, LGBTQ issues, and more. She's the founder of the Laurel Therapy Collective, a teletherapy practice based out of California. You can learn more about her work at laureltherapy.net. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in the